Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. I am now going to cover the first three verses of Ezekiel chapter 38. Why such a few amount of verses? Because Ezekiel 38 verses 1 through 3 talks about Gog and Magog, of which I'm sure you have heard if you've read Hal Lindsey or Tim LaHaye and have read all the futurist prophecy nuts out there telling us what Gog is. They act like they know for sure what it is. I think they're wrong, and I'm going to try to tell you they're wrong and prove to you that they're wrong. Now, there are a lot of interpretations of Gog. I have entitled this audio Preterist, Historicist, and Futurist Interpretation of Gog. But I'm going to give you what my interpretation is. I'm going to take the position that Gog is Haman in the book of Esther. I'll just tell you up front. I will consider briefly the other options, but I'm going to make a very strong case that Gog is Haman. So we start now in Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 3. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Now this word that came to Ezekiel is the same time as the previous prophecy, most probably, as Precept Austin says. Precept Austin has the last chapter, 37, at 585 BC. I had it at 584. It's close enough. It's right after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. So we go to verse 2. Yahweh says, Son of man, set your face against Gog. I have talked about that title, Son of man, at least 50,000 times as I have gone through the book of Ezekiel, because this audio is going to be somewhat long. I will skip that. Refer you to previous audios if you would like to hear something about that. So, Ezekiel, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog. Well, let's take Magog first. Who was Magog? He was a descendant of Noah through Japheth. We read in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10:2, Japheth's sons, Gomer, Magog, etc., etc., etc. Well, that's easy enough, but then the next question is why is Gog identified with Magog, Gog of the land of Magog? Gog is the person, the land is Magog. And I'm going to say that Gog refers to Haman for reasons I'll give you in just a minute. Well, why is Haman of the land of Magog? Well, the easiest answer to that is that Magog means land of Gog in the Hebrew. So Haman is of the land of Gog. Haman, who is Gog, is of the land of Gog. Or Gog is of the land of Gog. Gog has some certain land associated with him, and he's of it. That's the simplest way to handle that. Magog is Gog's land. Magog is Haman's land. So let's get down to the main issue here. Who is this Gog? Before I go to that, though, let me point out that there are other suggestions that I'm going to mention along the way, even though I don't agree with them. Here is what Answers.com says of Magog. According to Josephus, the descendants of Magog were the Scythians. The Scythians were an ancient tribe that inhabited the region north of the Black Sea and north and east of the Caspian Sea. Well, that'll work all right. If you take the Scythians, those are the southern Russians right north of the Black Sea and right north of the Caspian Sea, maybe on down into Georgia and Azerbaijan, maybe even further down into Armenia, all around there, the Scythians, the Romans talked about them all the time. Well, when we look at the sources, Meshech and Tubal are right smack dab in the middle of present-day Turkey, the Anatolian Peninsula. So if Magog is the Scythians, that's right in the general area, a little bit to the north of it. And if Gog is Haman, Haman, of course, was ruling, not ruling, but he was second in command in Persia, and his house was in Susa, which is in Elam, which is in the southwestern portion of Persia. But all of the people who are prophesied here against Haman are of Persian lands, whether it's Scythia, Meshech, Tubal. Persia owned all those lands, so that fits as far as I'm concerned, as in my stage of ignorance. So having taken care of the geography, Meshech, by the way, was the center of the Anatolian province, and Tubal was on the northern coast of Anatolia, the southern coast of the Black Sea. So let's get to Gog. Adam Clark says this is allowed to be the most difficult prophecy in the Old Testament. I would probably agree with that. Clark says, it is difficult to us because we do not know the king nor the people intended by the name Gog. And Clark is well satisfied that Gog and Magog were well known by these names in the time that Ezekiel wrote. Maybe that's true, but I think we'll see some other possibilities as we go through this audio. There are many, many, many opinions as to who Gog might be. Let me give you some weak preterist opinions. I'll start with preterist opinions first. Of course, a preterist is one who takes the primary meaning of a prophecy to be fulfilled locally or at a time very close to the time the prophecy was given. Preterist means past. Historicist takes the fulfillment of a prophecy somewhere in the Western Middle Ages, and a futurist takes fulfillments of prophecies to be at the very end of the planet Earth. So let's look at some opinions which I will consider weak preterist opinions. Adam Clark says there are two such opinions. He says the two most common opinions betwixt which there is much division of opinion in the quote-unquote ocean of conjecture. The first common opinion of Cambyses of Persia. He's said to be Gog on his return from Egypt. He conquered Egypt in 525 B.C. Then he died in Judea on the way out. I don't think so. The other weak preterist opinion is Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid emperor, who desecrated Jerusalem. I think it was 165 B.C. That's Adam Clark's opinion. In fact, James Jordan, the well-known Dominionist theologian, says that this was a very common opinion which he used to hold until he changed his opinion. So you'll see that a lot in Antiochus Epiphanes. Briefly, how does that argument work? The Roman author Pliny called the city of Hierapolis, which is in Syria. He said that the Syrians called this city Magog, and Gog is the same as Gyges, who was a king of Lydia in the 7th century B.C. Lydia is that kingdom in the western part of present-day Turkey, western part of Anatolia. Gog is Gyges, and Gyges is said to give his name to Magog, Gog's land. Gyges, by the way, was the grandfather of the very famous Lydian king Croesus, as in rich as Croesus' fame. And then, of course, right around 550 or so, I forgot the exact date, but Cyrus the Persian beat the Lydians, and so now Lydia is owned by the Persians, but then Alexander the Great beat the Persians, and so Alexander the Great now has Lydia. He dies. One of the successor kingdoms to Alexander the Great is the Seleucid Kingdom, which is based in Antioch, which of course is in Syria. Well, somehow that's supposed to say that Antiochus Epiphanes is Gog. I don't think so. I mention it just for the sake of completeness. Now let me give you the last of my weak preterist opinions. They're weak in my opinion. This is from G.B. Caird, who wrote a commentary of the Revelation of St. John the Divine, published in 1966. He says that Gog is a symbol for all the pagan nations of Psalm 2. We read in Psalms 2, verse 1, "Why do the nations rebel and the peoples plot in vain?" That famous psalm. And so Gog is a symbol for all those nations that are rebellious. Well, no, I don't think that's going to fly. So let's go to the best preterist opinion, the opinion that yours truly will adopt, and that is that Gog is Haman. James Jordan, I think, came up with this theory. James Jordan is a Dominionist, Reconstructionist, Reformed theologian. I think he was from Texas and Florida. He's a Southern guy. Can tell by his accent. Gary DeMar popularized James Jordan's theory. I found several other authors on the internet, people I've never heard of, who've adapted this theory, so it's not just me. Here's the theory in brief. Haman is Gog, and the nations from all over the world who attack Israel are the nations of the Persian Empire, the constituent nations of that empire. Now I'm going to start giving you arguments that Gog is Haman. I'm going to give you a lot of them. I'm going to number them to try to keep ourselves organized. I'm going to come up with 8. So let's start with argument number 1. Gog is said to be the chief prince. This is in verse 2. Gog is not said to be a king. Let me read verse 2. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Gog is the chief prince, not the king of, but the chief prince. In other words, he's the number one prime minister. Well, that fits Haman perfectly, because Haman was the prime minister of Ahasuerus, the king in the book of Esther. Argument number 2 for Haman being Gog. Haman is an Agagite, and Agog and Gog are equated in the Septuagint. If you look at Agog and Gog, two G's and two G's. Remember, Hebrew doesn't have vowels. Different people's pronunciation of the Hebrew is going to come up with different vowels. The vowels were not added until 500 to 1000 A.D. by the Masoretic scribes in Tiberias on the coast of the Sea of Galilee. So even looking at the English, you can tell Agag and Gog are quite close. And remember, Haman is an Agagite. Well, let's first show that Haman was an Agagite, Esther 3:1. After all this took place, King Ahasuerus honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite. So Hammedatha was an Agagite, and Hammedatha's son Haman was a Haggadite. We also see Haman referred to as an Agagite in Esther 9:24. For Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them. He cast the poor, that is, the lot, to crush and destroy them. So Haman is an Agagite. Now to show that Agag is Gog, we're going to look at the quotation of Numbers 24:7 in the ESV and then compare that with the Septuagint, the LXX. Numbers 24:7, water shall flow from Israel's buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Agag means that, by the way. It means high, exalted. Numbers 24:7 in the Septuagint. There shall come a man out of Israel's seed, and he shall rule over many nations. The kingdom of Gog shall be exalted, and his kingdom shall be increased. So there we see the same Hebrew word translated, one into English as Agag, and the other into Greek as Gog, and then, of course, transliterated into English as Gog. Agag and Gog are the same thing, and Haman is an Agagite. That ties him to Gog pretty closely. Let me give you a quote from Lewis B. Patton, or Payton, I don't know how to pronounce his name, P-A-T-O-N. He wrote a critical and exegetical commentary on the book of Esther. At page 194, he says, "It is accurate to refer to Agag as Gog in Scripture in light of the Septuagint's translation of Agag as Gog at Numbers 24:7. In fact, some Septuagint manuscripts say that Haman was a Gogite instead of an Agagite at Esther 3:1 and Esther 9:24, those verses I just read to you. That was Lewis B. Patton. Now let me quote you from a gentleman named Dennis Harrelson. "Clearly, there is an ancient connection between the titles of Agag and Gog and between an Agagite and being a Gogite. Therefore, since Haman was an Agagite, it is accurate to say he was a Gogite. Since Haman was Agag, the ruler of Amalek, it is accurate to say he was Gog. The parallel is already incredibly strong, but Ezekiel 39 drives the point home." Now we're going to go to Ezekiel 39 and show you some even more parallels between Haman and Gog. Haman's nationality, Agag, ties him to Gog, but also three passages in Ezekiel 39. Let's start with the first one, Ezekiel 39:11. This is the NASB translation, "And it will come about on that day that I will give Gog a burial ground there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by east of the sea, and it will block off the passers-by. So they will bury Gog there with all his multitude." We'll stop right there. That's the first parallel there, Gog and multitude. And you say in English, I don't see a parallel. And you can't see it in English, but let's look at the Hebrew. The Hebrew for Haman, and of course Haman is how I'm pronouncing it in English. The Hebrew is Haman. So Haman is pretty close to multitude. "So they will bury Gog there with all his multitude." Multitude in the Hebrew is Hamono. Now, Haman and Hamono, although they sound sort of alike, remember, the Hebrew didn't have vowels. Haman and Hamono have different vowels, but there were three consonants in both words, Haman and multitude, Hamono. And those three vowels are the same, He, Main, and Nun. Now, it's hard to believe that this is a coincidence. I believe that Ezekiel was making a play on the word Gog, who was Haman, and he's being buried there with his Hamono, his multitude. Ezekiel's perhaps making a play on words. Well, let's look at the second place where Haman is connected with Gog. That's at the very end of this same verse, Ezekiel 39:11. "So they will bury Gog there with all his multitude, and they will call it the valley of Haman Gog." Now in English, hey my God, that sounds pretty close, even in English. This is what James Jordan says. It seems to me that if I were a Jew living during the intertestamental era, I would be struck by the correspondence between Haman and Haman Gog, or Haman and Haman Gog, and it would cause me to consider whether or not they are related. Well, they certainly are related. In the transliteration in the English, Haman Gog in the NASB, there's a hyphen between the two, tying them together. And let's look at the Hebrew. Again, as I said, the Hebrew for Haman is Haman, and the Hebrew for Hamon, which is the proper name of the valley there, Hamon, that Hebrew has three consonants, He, Main, and Nun. Likewise, our Haman of the Book of Esther, he has three consonants, He, Main, and Nun. So let me read you what Dennis Harrelson has to say about that. The resting place of the army that invaded Israel is called Hamon Gog. Ezekiel 39 even links the name Hamon, which is obviously quite similar to Haman, Haman, with Gog, which we know is synonymous with Agag, as I've previously shown. It is quite possible that Ezekiel 39:11 plainly says that the place was called the Valley of Agag-Haman. In other words, a valley that was named after the Agagite Haman. When we consider all these arguments, I believe we can conclude that Gog in Ezekiel 38 is a reference to Haman. And I agree. Now let's go to the third example of parallels between the name Haman with other references in Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel 39:16 says this, "And even the name of the city will be Hamonah, so they will cleanse the land." Now the Holman Christian Study Bible note says that in Hebrew, Hamonah is related to the word horde. It's multitude, the same word we saw in Ezekiel 39:11, which said they will bury Gog there with all his multitude, all his Hamono. This is a Hamonah, very similar. Now, this name Hamonah, which, of course, has those same three consonants, He, Main, and Nun, same three consonants that Haman has, this was not a literal city. Dictionary.com, which is a secular source, says that it means multitude, a name figuratively, and I emphasize figuratively, assigned to the place in which the slaughter and burial of the forces of Gog were to take place, referring to Ezekiel 39:16. The Bible Guide in Answers.com says that Hamonah is the symbolic name of a city in the valley of Hamon Gog, in whose vicinity Ezekiel prophesied that the armies of Gog and his allies would be defeated in their struggle with Israel. So Hamonah is a symbolic name, which sounds an awful lot like Haman. It makes an awful lot of sense that the symbolic name Hamonah would be a play on words using the word Haman, Haman. Well, if you're not convinced yet, let me go to argument number four. Referring Gog to Haman fits perfectly the chronology of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 34 through 37 speaks of the restoration of Israel from the Persian Empire, which happened roughly 539, well, after that, maybe 538, 537, because of Cyrus the Great's edict saying the Jews could go back to Israel. Now, of course, there are secondary typological references to the New Covenant Church, as I've pointed out over and over again as we've gone through Ezekiel, but the primary reference was to the return from Babylon. For example, in Ezekiel 34, we see that God will be a good shepherd who will lead Israel back to the land. In Ezekiel 36, we see that God will make a new covenant with Israel. Ezekiel 37, we see the valley of the dry bones. Israel will be resurrected, and the union of the two sticks, the northern kingdom of Israel, will be united to the southern kingdom of Judah, and there will be one kingdom. So that's the restoration, Ezekiel 34 through 37. Now we get to our passage here in Ezekiel 38, and also the next chapter, which is also about Gog. These two chapters speak of Haman, i.e. Gog's, threat to restore Israel. Now, I found a date somewhere that said that Haman did his dirty work around 473. We know that Ahasuerus, if he's Xerxes, reigned from 486 to 465. Now, I know that James Jordan's got this theory that Ahasuerus is not Xerxes, but Darius. Well, I'm not going to get into that. I'm just going to assume that Ahasuerus is Xerxes. And if he's from 486 to 465, a date of 473 would be just about right for Haman. And that comes after the restoration, which was in 538/537. So now we're down to the 470s. And then when we go to the end of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 40 through 48, Ezekiel speaks of restored Israel under Ezra and Nehemiah primarily. Well, what are Ezra's dates? ESV.org has Ezra departing from Babylon to Jerusalem in 458, which is again after Esther. And then Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem from Babylon in 445, after Ezra and, of course, after Esther. So Ezra and Nehemiah's dates are after Haman's, just like Ezekiel 40 through 48, or after Ezekiel 38 and 39. So referring God to Haman keeps the chronological order of Ezekiel just perfectly. Argument number 5, that Gog is Haman. The deaths of the Jews' enemies in the book of Esther is commensurate with the extent of the slaughter that we see in Ezekiel 38 and 39. In Esther, it was 75,310 people that got killed, 10 of them in Esther 9:10. They killed these 10 sons of Haman. That's 10, plus 300 in Esther 9:15. The Jews in Susa assembled again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Susa. That's 310. And then we add 75,000 in Esther 9:16. The rest of the Jews in the royal provinces assembled, defended themselves, and got rid of their enemies. They killed 75,000 of those who hated them. Well, that's a lot of people in Esther that got killed. How about Ezekiel? Ezekiel 39, we see a great multitude of people got killed. Ezekiel 39:9. Then the inhabitants of Israel's cities will go out, kindle fires, and burn the weapons, the bucklers and shields, the bows and arrows, the clubs and spears. For 7 years they will use them to make fires. If you use the weapons of slain enemies for 7 years to burn, that's a whole heap of people that got killed. Ezekiel 39:12, the house of Israel will spend 7 months burying them in order to cleanse the land. A whole bunch of people. A whole bunch of corpses got killed. So in both books, Esther and Ezekiel, we see a large, extensive massacre and slaughter. Argument number 6, that Gog is Haman. The phrase in Esther 8, verse 9, provinces which were from India to Cush, fits the place names of Ezekiel 38 and 39. India, you know where India is, to the east of Persia, and Cush is Ethiopia, to the west of Persia. That range of geography fits well with how Ezekiel 38 starts out. From India to Cush is in Esther 8, verse 9. Ezekiel 38 starts out this way, listing a number of nations which were from all over the world, all of which were within the boundaries of the Persian Empire. Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 6. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, turn your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I've already talked about Magog, the land of Gog. That's not a specific place, but we got Meshach and Tubal. That's in present-day Turkey. Prophesy against him and say, this is what the Lord God says. Look, I'm against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with all your army, including horses and riders who are splendidly dressed, a huge company armed with shields and bucklers, all of them brandishing swords. Persia, Cush, and Put are with them, all of them with shields and helmets. Persia, of course, is the whole Persian Empire. Well, it's not the whole Persian Empire. It's the Iranian plateau to the east of the Tigris River, and in Cush is Ethiopia, Put is Libya. So you see, in Ezekiel 38, Gog, that's Haman, is attacked by places all through the Persian Empire. And, of course, how that happened was is when the Jews of all these places turned on Haman, when Haman's decree was reversed. Verse 6, Gomer with all his troops and Beth Togarmah from the remotest parts of the north. I am going to have to remember from the last chapter, I think Gomer and Beth Togarmah are somewhere in southeastern Turkey, southeastern Anatolia. So you see a wide expanse of places that are fighting against Gog. Let's look at Esther 8:9. On the 23rd day of the third month, the royal scribes were summoned. Everything was written exactly as Mordecai ordered for the Jews. To the satraps, the governors, and the officials of the 127 provinces from India to Cush. So you see a large geographical area that was involved in the conflict between the Jews and their enemies in both Ezekiel and Esther. Argument number 7, to attempt to show that Gog is Haman. Haman represents the ancient battle between Jews and the Amalekites. Remember we said that Haman was an Amalekite. He was an Agagite, which is the same thing as an Amalekite, because the kings of the Amalekites were called Agag. Let's read Ezekiel 38:17. This is what the Lord God says. Are you Gog? This is talking to Gog. Are you the one I spoke about in former times through my servants? Now, the first time that Ezekiel is mentioned, Gog, is right here in chapter 38. But here, Yahweh says, I spoke about you in former times. Well, how could that be? How could Gog have been spoken about in former times through God's servants, the prophets of Israel, who for years prophesied in those times that I would bring you against them? So for years, God has been prophesying against Gog. How is that possible? Well, it's because Gog is Haman, and Haman is an Agagite, and an Agagite is an Amalekite, and God's been prophesying against the Amalekites forever, for years. As KaiserCommentary.com says, if Gog and Magog are Amalek, then this makes sense. Many prophets spoke of Amalek, including Moses, Balaam, Samuel, Deborah, Gideon, an unnamed prophet in Judges 10, David, and Asaph in Psalm 83. They prophesied of multi-generational warfare in various places in the Torah in 1 Samuel. And so Haman is just the last chapter in that ongoing battle between the Amalekites and the Jews. Now I'm going to finish up my argument here by giving you miscellaneous parallels between Esther and Ezekiel. This will be my eighth argument that Haman is Gog. Parallel number one, the battle in Ezekiel occurs when Jerusalem and its daughters have no walls, its daughter villages have no walls. Ezekiel 38:11. You will say, I will go up against a land of open villages. I will come against a tranquil people who are living securely, all of them living without walls and without bars or gates. That's Gog that's going to do that. Well, that's true. There were no walls in Jerusalem. There were no walls in the villages around Jerusalem because Nehemiah had not started rebuilding the walls until after Esther's. I've already mentioned Nehemiah came after Esther. Esther's around in the 470s or so. Nehemiah's in 455. Miscellaneous parallel between Esther and Ezekiel number 2. Both passages portray universal fighting and not just in Palestine. Ezekiel 39:21. I will display my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see the judgment I have executed and the hand I have laid on them. So there's fighting not just in Palestine, but in the nations around in the ancient Near East. Ezekiel 39:6. I will send fire against Magog and those who live securely on the coasts and islands. Of course, that's referring to the coast and islands of the Mediterranean Sea. There were lots of them. Then they will know that I am Yahweh. And of course, we know that the fighting in Esther was all over the Persian Empire. So both in Ezekiel and Esther, fighting everywhere. Another parallel. Here's parallel number 3 between Esther and Ezekiel. The motive in both Esther and Ezekiel was to plunder the Jews. We read in Ezekiel 38:11-13, Again, Yahweh is speaking to Gog. You, Gog, will say, I will go up against a land of open villages. I will come against a tranquil people who are living securely, all of them living without walls and without bars or gates, in order to seize spoil and carry off plunder, to turn your hand against ruins now inhabited and against the people gathered from the nations who have been acquiring cattle and possessions and who live at the center of the world, the navel of the world. These people have been getting wealthy. And Gog is going to go take it. Verse 13, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish. Sheba is probably in present-day Yemen, southwestern quarter of Saudi Arabia. Dedan is in Saudi Arabia along the Red Sea coast. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish in Spain, probably with all its rulers, will ask you, have you come to seize spoil? Have you assembled your hordes to carry off plunder, to make off with silver and gold, to take cattle and possessions, to seize great spoil? So obviously, the inhabitants of the Persian Empire were thinking about getting rich off the Jews. That's in Ezekiel 38. Now, in Esther 3:13, we read this. Letters were sent by couriers to each of the royal provinces, telling the officials to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jewish people, young and old, women and children, and plunder their possessions on a single day. 13th day of Adar of the 12th month. So we see that there's a parallel there between Esther and Ezekiel. Likewise, our fourth parallel between Esther and Ezekiel, both passages show that the Jews were authorized to plunder those who tried to plunder them. In Esther 8:11, we read this, "The king's edict gave the Jews in each and every city the right to assemble and defend themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate every ethnic and provincial army hostile to them, including women and children, and to take their possessions as spoils of war." Well, that's very famous and familiar. How about Ezekiel 39:10? "They," this is referring to the Jews, "will not gather wood from the countryside or cut it down from the forest, for they will use the weapons to make fires. They will take the loot from those who looted them and plunder those who plundered them." So you see that reversal, a plunder reversal, if you will. Exactly what happened in Esther happened in Ezekiel 39. Here's our fifth parallel between Esther and Ezekiel. In both books, Esther and Ezekiel, the planned destruction of the Jews is reversed, and it comes on the enemy. Here's parallel number six. In both Esther and Ezekiel, there were some Gentiles who helped the Jews in their distress. Esther 9:3, "All the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the royal civil administrators aided the Jews because they were afraid of Mordecai." So the Jews got some help with the pagan Gentile officials in Esther, and we read also in Ezekiel 38:21, "I will call for a sword against him on all my mountains, the declaration of the Lord God, and every man's sword will be against his brother." So some Gentiles got involved in civil war and started attacking other Gentiles, which of course would help the Jews out. So in both Esther and Ezekiel, we see Gentiles helping out the Jews. Parallel number seven. In both Esther and Ezekiel, Gentiles are confronted with the truth of Yahweh. In Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 23, "I will display my greatness and holiness and will reveal myself in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am Yahweh." Esther 8:17, "In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his law reached, joy and rejoicing took place among the Jews. There was a celebration and a holiday." That's Purim. "And many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews because fear of the Jews had overcome them." So, ethnic groups in Esther became Jews when they realized how powerful Yahweh was. And Ezekiel says that Yahweh will display his greatness and holiness in the sight of many nations so that Gentiles will see it. Not just Jews, but Gentiles also. And also, in our eighth parallel between Ezekiel and Esther, we see that in both passages, Jews gain respect and influence among the nations. Well, thus concludes my arguments that Haman is Gog. If I had a case that strong and had to go into court to defend it, I'd feel pretty good. Now, here are some advantages of the Haman theory, that Haman is Gog. This is from Gary DeMar. His article, "Is It in the Bible?" He says, "We can take Ezekiel 38 and 39 at its primary literal meaning without resorting to allegorizing." Now, all futurists have got to do that. They've got to make a modern battle in the future fit the ancient technology that's mentioned in Ezekiel 39 in our next chapter. I mentioned the burning of the wood for the weapons and so forth. Horses doesn't fit. So you have to allegorize to get there. And you know, dispensationalist futurists, they hate allegorizing, but boy, they'll do it in a minute when it comes to Ezekiel 39. Another advantage of the Haman theory is the Bible itself gives us the interpretation. By comparing Scripture with Scripture, which I've just done, the average Christian can interpret the Bible. There's no need for prophecy experts or speculation what might happen in the future. Our interpretation is not dependent on changes in future historical events because the interpretation of Ezekiel 38 and 39 is found within the Bible, not in newspaper headlines. Now, having stated such a strong case for the Haman theory, let me mention some objections to it. These objections are from Thomas Ice, the well-respected dispensational scholar who loves to attack Orthodox preterists in his writings. He does it nicely. I mean, I don't mean he's being obnoxious about it, but he is a dyed-in-the-wool futurist and dispensationalist. And his objection, and this is the primary objection, is that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is not literally fulfilled. Ice gives an example, Ezekiel 38:16. Ice says that Jews are attacked in the land of Israel according to that verse. And other verses in our two chapters in Ezekiel 38 and 39, Jews are attacked in the land of Israel, but in Esther, they are attacked all over the Persian Empire. Therefore, says Ice, the prophecy has not been fulfilled, literally. Well, let me read Ezekiel 38:16 a verse that Ice quotes, "You will advance against my people Israel like a cloud covering the land. You, Gog, will do this. It will happen in the last days, Gog, that I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I show myself holy through you in their sight." "You will advance against my people Israel," says Ezekiel in chapter 38, verse 16. But that's not in the land of Israel. Well, verse 16 doesn't say anything about the land of Israel. It just says, "You will advance against my people Israel, Gog." So that's not really an objection. I don't know why that verse was quoted by Ice. I went and found a better one. Ezekiel 38:8. "After a long time, you, Gog, will be summoned. In the last years, you will enter a land that has been restored from war and regathered from many peoples to the mountains of Israel, which had long been a ruin. They were brought out from the peoples, and all of them now live securely." In the last years, you will enter a land that has been restored from war. And thus, we see Ice's objection that the prophecy has not been fulfilled literally because Gog is going to enter Israel. Well, first of all, Gog, Haman, is not going to literally be entering anywhere in the Persian Empire. He just has his officials doing his dirty work. And so in Ezekiel 38:8, we've got the war against the Jews in the land of Canaan. But in Esther, Haman's men attack all over the Persian Empire. Ice continues, and he asks, "Why is the land of Israel not even mentioned in Esther 9, while the Persian capital of Susa and many other place names in the empire are referenced?" Well, that's an argument from silence. The simple answer to this is the Jews were attacked in Palestine and in the other areas of the Persian Empire, and the attack of the Jews in Palestine just was not mentioned for no particular reason. I don't consider that objection very powerful. Here's objection number two of how the prophecy is not literally fulfilled. Dead bodies are buried in Israel, as recorded in Ezekiel 39, verse 12. "The house of Israel will spend 7 months burying them in order to cleanse the land." Eretz, the land. But Ice says all of the dead bodies weren't buried in Israel in the book of Esther. To which I reply, so what? Ezekiel in chapter 39, verse 12, doesn't say that all the dead bodies were buried in the land of Israel. It just says that bodies were buried there. That doesn't mean that other bodies weren't buried in Susa or somewhere else in the Persian Empire. Another weak argument. Here's a third example of how Ice claims that the prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39 are not fulfilled literally. In Ezekiel, says Ice, the invaders were destroyed by earthquakes, fire from heaven, plagues, and infighting. But in Esther, the enemies were destroyed by the Jews themselves. Well, the answer to that is earthquakes, fire from heaven, plagues, and so forth. That's symbolic language to describe the destruction of the enemies. It doesn't mean that Gog, Haman, went around and started an earthquake to beat his enemies, or that he called down lightning from heaven or fire from heaven. Remember, Ice is a hyper-literalist. He's a dispensationalist. He's got to take everything literal, except for that war in chapter 38. Here's another example that Ice brings up to show that Ezekiel did not literally fulfill Haman's activities. Ezekiel describes a surprise invasion, while Esther 9 speaks of the Jews who knew the exact day. It was Adar the 13th. It was Adar the 13th, according to Esther 9:1, when the king's edict would be executed. Now, I don't know where in Ezekiel the invasion was said to be a surprise. I seems to think so. Maybe if I looked hard, I could find it. But I didn't see it, so I'm not too worried about that one. Here's argument number five, how the prophecy is allegedly not literally fulfilled. No one in Ezekiel's prophecy was killed by hanging on a gallows, as were Haman and his 10 sons in Esther, chapter 9, verse 13. Now that is a very weak argument from silence. Just because Ezekiel didn't mention it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Let's go to Thomas Ice's argument number 6, as he tries to show that Haman did not fulfill Ezekiel's prophecies concerning Gog in chapters 38 and 39. Says Ice, in Ezekiel, Persia is one of the invaders that is wiped out by the Lord, while in Esther 9, it's different. The Persians are the good guys in Esther 9. They aid the Jews. They're not the bad guys like they are in Ezekiel. Well, that is easy to answer. I've got 75,310 answers to that objection. That's how many Persians were wiped out in the book of Esther. It's true that after the massacre, the surviving Persians decided to help the Jews, but what about before the massacre? The Persians were the enemy. just like in Ezekiel, the Persians are the enemy. So that argument is not going to fly. We go now to example number 7 that Ice gives us, saying that Haman does not fulfill the Ezekiel prophecies about Gog. Says Ice, the Jews in Esther 9 are not regathered from the nations and living in Israel, as Ezekiel describes that. Instead, says Ice, the Jews and Esther were struggling along with Esther in the battle against Mordecai. Well, the simple answer to that is the Jews in Canaan were restored and at rest at the time of Esther. The Jews in Persia were not at rest because Ezekiel and Esther were talking about two different sets of Jews. That doesn't make them in conflict with each other. So we see, in my humble opinion, Ice does not do a very good job in answering the very strong case that Haman is Gog. Now let me summarize a defensive statement by James Jordan, who says this: this argument does not have much force with me. The argument that the fighting against the Persians took place in the land of Israel in Ezekiel, but took place all over the Persian Empire in Esther. This argument does not have much force with me because of the fact that this entire section of Ezekiel is so highly symbolic in tone anyway. Chapter 37 gives us the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones, after all, and chapters 40 through 48 are a thoroughly geometrical vision of the Restoration Temple. Thus, I can see no difficulty in assuming that Ezekiel is picturing the final worldwide attack of Amalek and his cohorts under the imagery of an attack on the land, imagery derived from the book of Judges. In other words, Ezekiel pictures in his mind the historical attacks on the land of Israel, and he uses those historical attacks on the land of Israel as pictures to describe the attack of Haman's Persians on the people of Israel in the Persian Empire, and I think that pretty well takes care of the problem. Again, the whole issue is hermeneutics. You want to be a hyperliteralist? You can't be consistent about it. You can't be consistent when you say, or if you want to say, that chapters 40 through 48 are literal. They obviously cannot be. That temple has dimensions that are impossible to fulfill in the real physical world. The water runs uphill, for crying out loud, as it comes out of the temple. That can't be literal. And bones coming to life in a valley, is that literal? Of course not. So if you got all of this other stuff in Ezekiel as symbolic, why not here? In a few places, not many. Just the attack on Israel. It was done by Persian officials, whereas the language in Ezekiel had it done with earthquakes and pestilence and horses. That's just imagery. It's not a problem. Another minor objection to Jordan's view that Haman is Gog is that Libya, Put, is outside the Persian Empire. And Put is mentioned here in Ezekiel. So if Esther is talking about the Persian Empire and Haman's involved in fighting Jews within the Persian Empire, Ezekiel has Put being involved in the fight against Gog, and so therefore Haman can't be Gog. Well, the answer to that is Put was probably allied tightly with Persia, so that's a minor problem. Another objection brought out by futurists is, why did no one in Esther's day notice the fulfillment? There's no mention in Esther that the movements against Haman fulfilled Ezekiel's prophecy. It's also objected that no Jewish scholars in that day, there were none, who recognized this fulfillment or subsequently. Well, my response to that is, Esther doesn't mention God either. The author of the book of Esther had to be careful talking about God, and I would say he had to be careful about talking about fulfilled prophecy too. He was living in Persia, not Israel. And if you went around saying, look at here, Haman's downfall was predicted by the prophet Ezekiel, that might have caused him some political problems. Well, let's move off from the preterist view of Gog and futurist objections to that preterist view that it's Haman. Let's look at some historicist opinions. Now remember, historicists say that Gog is fulfilled at the times of the Western Middle Ages, right around the times of the Protestant Reformation. Historicists eschatology is a great example of newspaper eschatology. When the headlines change, the interpretations change. Let me give you some examples. In the 4th and 5th centuries, the view was that Gog was the Goths and the Moors, because those were the enemies of Christendom at that time. In the 5th century, Gog was the Huns as they attacked Europe. In the 8th century, by the time the Muslims got around to attacking Europe, Gog was the Muslims. And then in the 10th century, Gog was the Hungarians. And in the 16th century, Gog was either the Turks and the Saracens, or Gog was the papacy, depending on whom was angering the writer enough at the time. In the 17th century, Gog was Spain and Rome, because those were the two Catholic countries opposing Protestantism. In the 19th century, Gog was Napoleon. In the 20th century, Gog was communist Russia. That's the Gog I grew up with. Well, you can see that. What kind of a view is that that changes when the newspaper headlines change? So we're not going to pay any attention to the historicist opinions, and we will go now to futurist opinions. I'm going to give you three arguments for our future fulfillment. Argument number one, nothing has happened so far to fit Ezekiel's prophecy. And whenever there is a hard prophecy in the Old Testament and we can't find a fulfillment of it, you can bet a futurist will launch off into the far unknown worlds of the future and say, this is when it's going to happen. It's so convenient because you don't have to defend anything anymore. You can just say it's in the future. We don't know the details of it yet because it hasn't happened, but that's when it's going to be because it hasn't been fulfilled yet. Let me read Thomas Ice here. The view of a massive invasion of Israel in the end times has not yet occurred in history, in spite of claims to the contrary. No event in Israel's past history since the time of Ezekiel's prophecy even comes close to fitting the details of Ezekiel 38 and 39, especially Esther 9. Therefore, since the prophecy must be literally fulfilled, it must still be future even in our day. Not even close? No event in Israel's past history comes even close to fitting the details of Ezekiel 38 and 39. It seems to me that James Jordan and his buddies, whose works I've cited extensively in this audio, they've given some pretty good details that come close to fitting the details of Ezekiel 38 and 39. That's just silly. Another argument, Ezekiel 38:8 says that the fulfillment of the prophecies about Gog will happen in the latter days or the latter years. Ezekiel 38:8. After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had been a continual waste. But its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. The latter years, folks, means the latter years of the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant era. Now, I know when you use those magic words in front of prophecy nuts today, they'll start talking about the Antichrist and 666 and chips under their wrist skin and black helicopters, nuclear bombs going off. It has nothing to do with that, folks. It has to do with the end of the Old Covenant era. And, of course, the restoration of Israel happened at the end of the Old Covenant era, 538/537, they came back. Temple's rebuilt, 520-516. Then we got the intertestamental period. You're at the end of the Old Covenant. That's the latter years, or the last days, as it's sometimes called. In fact, in Ezekiel 38:16, we see that phrase, last days. And you will come up against my people Israel, this is Gog, like a cloud to cover the land. It will come about in the last days that I shall bring you against my land. See there, that's the end of the world. No, it's not. It's in the last days of the Old Covenant era, and in the early 5th century B.C., when Haman was operating, that was in the last days of the Old Covenant period of history. It will come about in the last days that I shall bring you against my land, in order that the nations may know me when I shall be sanctified through you before their eyes, O Gog. Now, let's look at how futurist time, this futurist invasion of Gog. Now, the preterists have no trouble timing it. They just tell you whenever Haman did it, that's when it happened. But, oh, listen to the futurist. The battle with Gog could occur before the rapture, after the rapture, before the tribulation, at the first half of the tribulation, towards the middle of the tribulation, at the end of the tribulation. And, in fact, some people say the battle of Gog is the same as the battle of Armageddon, which is right before the second coming. Or it could be at the beginning of the millennium, or it could be at the end of the millennium. In fact, Gog is actually mentioned, Gog and Magog, at the end of Revelation 20, which is the end of the millennium being the church age between the first and second advent, according to the non-Kiliastic view. But of course, these futurists are usually pre-mills, and so they can put it at the end of the millennium as they can put it anywhere else. Just all speculation. Now, here's the main objection to futurist options. Futurists claim they strongly believe in a literal interpretation. Oh, they love that word, literal. Literal, 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 all the time. They're talking about literal. And then the first chance they get when they have to, they resort to symbolism. The example of this is the terminology in Ezekiel 38, and I love this. This is one of those embarrassing sights for futurist interpretation. Here's Gary DeMar quoting a futurist, Chuck Missler. Or he's actually not quoting Missler, he's complaining about what Missler has said. Chuck Missler attempts to get around the description of ancient war implements by claiming that the various Hebrew words is simply a 2,500-year-old language that could be describing a mechanized force. The word translated horse actually means leaper. That can also mean bird or even chariot rider. I guess that's your airplane. He tells us that the Hebrew word translated sword has become a generic term for any weapon or destroying instrument. Really now? In a similar way, arrow means piercer and is occasionally used for thunderbolt and could be translated today as a missile. That's literal interpretation? We are to believe that bow is what launches the missile. A bow and arrow is a missile launcher and a missile. I mean, please. Is Missler trying to tell us that when Ezekiel wrote bow and arrow, he really meant a launching pad for a missile? I'm quoting DeMar now. To follow his interpretive methodology requires us to believe that the meaning of the Bible has been inaccessible to the people of God for nearly 2,500 years. Missler, like nearly all end-time prognosticators, breaks all the rules of exegesis. DeMar, in another place, says this. There is nothing in the context that would lead the reader to conclude that horses, war clubs, swords, bows, and arrows, and spears mean anything other than horses, war clubs, swords, bows, and arrows, and spears. And what is the Russian Air Force after? Gold, silver, cattle, and goods? In what modern war can anyone remember armies going after cattle? How much cattle does Israel have? Certainly not enough to feed the Russians. So you see, all of this prophecy nonsense that I was raised on is nonsense. It's a good thing I didn't lose my faith being pumped full of this stuff, because when I realized this was foolish, the thought did cross my mind, well, maybe Christianity's foolish too, because it's all Christians I know are teaching me this stuff, and it's nonsense. It's absolute, utter bunk. I hate to get polemical here, but there are so many people that are ensnared by this nonsense that I have to get a little bit worked up over it. Now, one last comment before we leave our discussion of Gog. Gog is mentioned in Revelation 20 as a symbol, pagan peoples rising up against the new Israel, the church. So at the end of the millennium, the church age, between the first and the second advents, not some millennium off in the future, but the true millennium, between the first and the second advents, there are going to be pagan peoples rising up against the church. And John calls them Gog symbolically because Haman is a great symbol, is he not? He hated the old Israel's Jews, just like whoever Gog is going to be in the future is going to hate Christians. Well, we finished with verse 1. Now let's go to verse 2. Well, now we finished with Gog, so let's go to the rest of verse 2. I've talked about Gog of the land of Magog. Gog is also said to be the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. As I've said, Meshech is in the center of Anatolia, present-day Turkey. Tubal is on the southern edge of the Black Sea at the northern rim of Anatolia, present-day Turkey. Prophesy against Gog. And by the way, the reason that Haman is said to be the chief prince of that is because he was in charge of those areas. Prophesy against Gog and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I'm against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Now Gog is said to be the chief prince. This comes from the Hebrew word Rosh, which means head. He's the head prince, the chief prince. Now, dispensationalists, I'm trying to be nice. Let's just put it this way. Prophecy nuts try to show that a future invasion coming from Gog is based on this. Gog is the chief prince. He's Rosh, so therefore Gog is Russia. And Meshach is Moscow, and Tubal is Tobolsk, both of which are Russian countries, and therefore, Hal Lindsey said it, the last time's invasion's coming from Russia. Actually, C.I. Schofield first introduced this idea in his ridiculous Bible with the Schofield Notes, and that silly idea has been repeated by Hal Lindsey and Disbys ever since. Let me read what DeMar says about that. The Hebrew word Rosh that is found in Ezekiel 38:2 is said to be a people group that refers to modern-day Russia. Part of the argument rests on the belief that Rosh sounds like Russia. Those who hold this view translate Ezekiel 38:2 this way. Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. The key phrase is Prince of Rosh, which they would have us to understand is the leader of Russia. Damar, in order to refute that nonsense, says this. A more accurate translation, the one followed by the King James Version, based on the way Rosh is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, would read this way. Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Even scholars who would agree with LaHaye on many other prophetic points admit that Rosh does not refer to Russia. Of course it doesn't refer to Russia. Charles Ryrie, and he's the prince of dispensationalists, he even takes issue with the New American Standard translation of Ezekiel 38:2 when he writes, the prince of Rosh is better translated as the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. The translation I used, NIV, has the chief prince, not the prince of Rosh. Meshach and Tubal are not linked with a place called Rosh in any other place in the Bible. So it is extremely unlikely that in these two cases alone, Rosh takes on an entirely different meaning from the way it is used elsewhere in the Old Testament. Another quote from Damar. The Rosh equals Russia interpretation was introduced to Christians in the first edition of the Scofield Reference Bible in 1917. Well, there it is. That's where it came from. Scofield wrote that the reference to Meshach and Tubal, Moscow and Tobolsk, is a clear mark of identification, i.e. with Russia. The views of Scofield, Lindsay, and LaHaye are not supported by Bible-believing Christian historians, archaeologists, and linguists. Edwin M. Yamauchi, professor of history at Miami University in Oxford, that's a famous guy, and I sure hope I didn't mispronounce his last name. Edwin M. Yamauchi is an authority on the subject and disagrees with Lindsay's analysis. He writes that the Hebrew word Rosh can have nothing to do with modern Russia. This would be a gross anachronism, for the modern name is based upon the name Rus, which was brought into the region of Kiev, north of the Black Sea, by the Vikings only in the Middle Ages. I had to go into some great detail over that because I remember that from my high school days reading this stuff. Oh, Rus is Russia. Of course, back then, in the 1960s, Russia was the evil empire that was threatening to take over the world with communism, and my dispensationalist futurist grandmother showed me a map of all the nations that the communists had conquered. It was a map of the world, and it was mostly red. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh. Of course, the communists had fallen on hard times since then, which is what I hope happens to the woke antichrist who are now polluting American and Western culture. I hope they fall on hard times pretty soon and are destroyed. Perhaps I should put out an interpretation that Gog is the woke. I mean, if everybody else can participate in newspaper eschatology, why can't I? Ladies and gentlemen, we have spent a long time going through a mere three verses, but we are now prepared to deal with the rest of Ezekiel 38 in our next audio, which I will call Prophecy Against Gog Part B. Hope you stay tuned for that. Hope you enjoyed this audio.